I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on Preston, Swindon and St Albans Community Radio. Bristol Community FM have, however, suspended Dialect indefinitely due to a nearly 30-minute long excerpt of a speech by Bible scholar Gail Ripplinger. So maybe we should repeat that next week. Anyway, this week, Silky Carlo, the crypto party, Maz Salim, also whose father was murdered in Birmingham 2 years ago as he walked home from the mosque. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're at Dialect Radio, oneword.co.uk. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. I'll repeat that contact detail at the end of the show. Silky, could I just ask you to introduce yourself and tell us where you're talking to us from?
I'm Silky Carlo. I'm speaking to you from Brighton this evening. I'm an information security trainer and a journalist. And as an information security trainer, that basically means that I am helping people defend themselves against hacking and surveillance, either from, you know, average criminal hackers or the government.
Now, I know you run these crypto parties, Silky. Tell us how that all started. What is a crypto party?
A crypto party is a free open workshop for people to gain privacy tools and digital security skills. So we teach people what the best browser to use is, what the risks and benefits of different operating systems, how to encrypt pieces of data, how to send and receive encrypted emails, or to set up encrypted instant messengers. It's good fun.
But surely, you know, it's impossible to really encrypt things because the National Security Agency, GCHQ, have got these gigantic computers which number crunch and they will crack any codes that you do. I mean, that's what they're there for.
Some lower grade types of encryption may be breakable. That's possible. Also, encryption might be considered less reliable if it's provided by a service that you're using. So, for example, when Facebook says that your chat messages are encrypted, it's encrypted using their tech, which they can choose whether to apply or to take away. The best kind of encryption is the encryption that you use on your end, from your computer, which is called end-to-end encryption. And that's what we do with email encryption, for example. That can't be broken.
Well, it's easy to say that, but hang on. I mean, we've heard about these Trojans, things like that, that can sit on your computer, key loggers that are logging keystrokes. So yeah. Even if you think that it's being encrypted, it might be that there's something sitting on your computer watching your every move.
Yeah, sadly, that's true. So although the encryption can't be broken, the next best thing for snoopers to do is to circumvent the encryption. And as generally digital security is being undermined by intelligence agencies, it's becoming easier to circumvent that encryption. So exactly as you said, if I'm using an encrypted email, encrypted email software, and the government decided it wants to target me to read my emails, it could, install something like a keylogger or some kind of deep level software that could just basically take ownership of my computer. And then it doesn't really matter what software I'd be using because they'd be able to scoop up that data and that information anyway. That's if you're a target of surveillance. But I think for the average person, if you want to protect your privacy and not be hoovered up into the mass surveillance dragnet, then using encryption is a really, really valuable tool for protecting your privacy.
Also, you know, you've got, you say targets, but I mean, anybody with money surely is a target. If they're using any kind of internet banking, well, as soon as you've got someone's password and you can get onto their internet banking system or sniff their keywords that they have to use on that, then you have access to their money.
Yeah, I mean, that's a slightly different issue. That's more like criminal hacking. And criminal you know, your average hacker isn't going to have the tools to really, certainly not to break encryption. Some of them will be able to do things like inject malware, which is bad software, so where they can have greater ownership over your computer. But it's a different issue to the one of encryption, and it's slightly different to, but it is different to government surveillance.
Okay, so how does that malware get onto your computer? How do you, you know, would you know if say you'd clicked something and that had downloaded some of this Trojan or whatever they're called onto your own personal computer?
Yeah, I mean, you might not know if you have picked up some malware whilst you've been online. There are perhaps some ways of detecting, and if you have a good antivirus software that you keep up to date regularly, then that might pick up on known malware. Generally, people just need to use good practices when they're online. Don't open dodgy email attachments. You know, some of the classic ways that hackers try to get your information. There are other modes of attack whereby a website that you visit is actually a man in the middle. It's not the website you actually want to visit. It's pretending that it is. And for that, there are, you know, to protect against that, you should make sure that your connection to the website is secure and encrypted. So there's an extension you can use on a web browser called HTTPS Everywhere. HTTPS Everywhere, and that's a good extension to use on a browser, especially, I mean, you shouldn't be using Internet Explorer, anything like that. You should be using something like an open source browser like Firefox or Chromium is good for Mac.
Okay, could you actually run through some of the better, because I mean, everybody uses internet browsers, there are all sorts of other bits of software we use, including antivirus. Now, I personally, I mean, I've seen lots of people, for example, using AVG antivirus, which looks great. You can update it regularly, but in my experience, it doesn't actually find the viruses you need it to find. Have you got a bit of advice on browsers, antivirus software, some of the things that you think that work, including things like firewalls?
Well, I'm a Mac user, and on Mac has pretty good antivirus protection already, and it also has a firewall that you can just choose to use in your settings, your system preferences. Good browsers that people should use. You should use a browser where you can have privacy enhancing extensions. So an extension is kind of like when you put an app on your phone, it's like adding extra features to the browser. That's essentially what an extension is. So if I were a Windows user, I would probably use Firefox as my everyday web browser. And then when you have a look at the extensions you can use with Firefox, I would use things like HTTPS Everywhere. There's an extension called NoScript, which stops JavaScript loading on the page, which is another protection method. If as a Mac user, I think Chromium is a really good browser that also you can use privacy enhancing extensions on. Chromium is the open source version of Google's Chrome browser.
Now, just a minute. When you say open source, what's the difference between that and, say, something like Google Chrome or Internet Explorer, open source? Why does it matter to have an open source browser?
Yeah, I advocate open source software generally, not just for browsers, but for any software application that you have. Open source is always a preferable option. Open source means that the source code that was used to design the piece of software is in the open. That is, it's published and available for public scrutiny. So helpful techies and hackers and people that are good at these kinds of things can then audit that source code. And they can, you know, make sure they're secure, that there's no little nasty backdoors in there or surveillance elements.
Now, no, the implication there is possibly browsers like Internet Explorer are doing things that you don't want them to do, and you don't know that they're doing, because that's part of Microsoft's source code, which they're not telling you, because it's closed source, not open source. Is that right?
That's absolutely right, and that's going to continue if the current version of the draft investigatory powers bill goes through Parliament successfully, because in there they have made clear that communication service providers, which to you and me, you know, would be like our Facebook, our Twitter, those providers must assist the UK government in obtaining data as and when they want. That can mean interference. That can mean not just, you know, hand over what it is that you have on the person, but it can also mean injecting malware. It can also mean actually actively collecting data from that person and assisting them with interception techniques.
So basically that means adding all sorts of powers to the ones that exist now. You know, we know that this, since the days of Edward Snowden, people like me who were talking about this stuff, who were some people call us paranoid, you know, you're talking nonsense, since the days of Edward Snowden, which is actually roughly 2 years ago that he came on up out in Hong Kong, and then went, eventually he's now pretty much in exile in Russia. This IP bill, investigatory powers bill, has now been, just literally in the last couple of weeks, has been published. It's now going to be debated by the House of Lords, the House of Commons, Parliament. Could become law. What are you? You know, you've had a pretty good look at this, and you've been reading around the subject, Silky. Tell us about this bill. What does it really mean?
That's a good question, because it's 300 pages of very, very dense but also very vague wording, and I've been reading quite carefully on it, and resisting the temptation to make immediate judgments. The longer I've spent looking at it, I honestly think the worse that it is. There it appears as though it gives us warranted surveillance with judicial oversight. It doesn't. The judicial oversight is basically a kind of, it is a rubber stamping. The judicial oversight is to ensure that correct procedure has been followed. It doesn't relate to the decisions that have been made about warranting a particular person's surveillance,
okay,
at all.
Because that's actually then not actually judicial oversight, really, is it? If you're saying that, oh, you know, the judges will just look to see if you've ticked the right boxes, they're not actually saying, well, this person needs to be under surveillance or not, which is what the whole point of having warrants for surveillance is there for. I mean, that's just, it sounds to me as if what's going on here is an attempt maybe to get into law stuff that has been done by these intelligence agencies in secret, in the knowledge that nobody knows what they're doing, so no evidence could be produced against them in court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gets worse. They have to make sure, you know, the judicial commissioner has to make sure the correct procedure has been followed, which basically means they don't really have the power to stop a decision, as long as the decision has been made, as you said, sort of ticking the right boxes, following the correct procedure. But the purposes for which somebody can obtain a warrant to surveil someone are for national security, but the government and within law, national security has never been defined, and we've seen that being abused time and time again.
So I wonder if maybe they can look at Tony Blair's emails, since he seems to be jeopardising national security by starting illegal wars.
Well, yes, exactly. I think the applications of the term national security are pretty broad. And if you think that, you know, considering David Cameron deems Jeremy Corbyn to be a national security threat, then you can really see, you know, the scope for political applications of that are really quite vast.
They are. And also, I mean, just let me bring you back to the Watergate scandal in the US in the 1970s. Now, that really was about the Republican President Nixon using the Secret Service to thwart, attack, and even some would say destroy the Democratic Party. Mm. Actually, what you're saying there almost sounds like that's a kind of Watergate-style thing, where the Secret Services are being used by the sitting government to attack the opposition parties.
Yeah, I mean, I think when David Cameron came out and said that Jeremy Corbyn was a national security threat and a threat to our families, even, he said, you know, a lot of people kind of, like, it got a lot of attention. A lot of people kind of laughed it off. But I'm sitting here thinking, wow, is that where British politics has come to? You know, if you put that in the context of all these, you know, other draconian laws like the Investigatory Powers Bill, it makes you really think, okay, let's define national security, because otherwise it's just being, the potential for it to be abused is vast. Just other purposes for which they can surveil and intercept. One which really worries me. The other one is economic well-being, which basically could lead to corporate spying. That worries me. It can be used, and it's largely being used, for prevention and detection of crime. Now, that wording really worries me, because if we're using mass surveillance for the detection of crime, that suggests to me that we're using it without suspicion, that we're using it to find crime. Everyone's a suspect.
Amazing.
That really worries me.
Well, yeah, and also if you put that in parallel with the announcement a couple of weeks ago saying that there may not be any more bobbies on the beat anymore, no police going on the streets, that does also imply that the police and security services are just going to rely on these CCTV cameras. Sounds like we're heading towards this kind of 1984 Orwellian style Britain.
I actually think, I mean, on the one hand, I don't, you know, you don't want to be an alarmist. And on the other hand, I really do, because I actually think that we've surpassed the Orwell 1984 dystopian nightmare in many senses. We've certainly surpassed it in the sense that we currently have an extraordinarily advanced infrastructure for what could be a tyrannical government. It's not a sensible thing to possess that infrastructure. And any government that ever has possessed that kind of infrastructure has gone down a very dark route. You know, it's very hard to have that power and then maintain a free and democratic society. I mean, how concerning are the statistics on the amount of interception warrants that there actually are as well? Last year, there were just under 3,000 interception warrants that were authorised. I worked that out to be about, you know, for every day that Theresa May turns up at work, that's about 14 warrants that she's authorising. If you spend about half an hour on each assessing the evidence that's there, then that's a 7-hour a day job. She's obviously not, you know, properly authorizing all of these warrants. I seriously question whether she's able to properly authorize these warrants. And it's just reminding me a little bit of kind of what you saw in like early 20th century Russia, you know, like just thousands of warrants. It's the appearance of procedure and democratic oversight, but it's an illusion. It's so, just mass surveillance.
So how do we know whether we're actually being hacked under surveillance or whether we're being paranoid? Is there any way to tell?
If you're talking about by the government, how do we know if we're being surveilled, you know, spied on by the government? We all are. All of our data is being ingested by the tools at GCHQ.
Now, hang on, because what about the... I mean, that what they'll say is, if you say that, they'll say, oh, well, we keep records of which phone numbers have been dialed and which internet sites have been visited, but we won't keep any kind of record of, you know, for example, specific pages on the internet or conversations that have been had over the phone.
Well, there's different opinions on this. The first off, on web pages, it's my understanding that through certain types of metadata that they collect, that they can see what web pages you visit specifically. Without a warrant, they can see what website you visited. With a warrant, they can see what actual websites you visited. So I think that's also collected in other metadata. As for the content of calls, we wouldn't know whether or not content of calls is being collected or not. I have heard from whistleblowers that I've spoken to, that I've interviewed in the US, that content is collected over there for a period of time, which makes me think it would be by GCHQ as well. But we don't know. I suppose it's an area that will remain dark. But they certainly have the abilities to collect phone content of anyone that they want to.
So is there any way to know if your computer breaks down, starts doing funny things, whether that's actually someone hacking you or whether it's just a glitch? Because, I mean, this seems to be one of the ways that the authorities or criminals trick us, is by actually, getting into our computer and disrupting our activity and making it look like it's just some, you know, computer says no.
If you are targeted by a criminal hacker, like a fraudster, then you might notice that the performance on your machine decreases. You might notice some glitches. If you're being targeted by a government agency, then they could potentially have a lot of ownership over your machine, over your devices, without there being any sort of detectable signs at all.
So when you say ownership, what do you mean? I mean, it doesn't mean they can do more with your computer than you can. They can change your passwords, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that they would be unlikely to do that, because they normally just want to collect data. They don't necessarily want to stop you from doing things. In fact, they want to be unnoticeable. What I mean by ownership is that they can achieve quite a deep level of control over your machine. Key logging is a fairly simple one, but they can potentially have access to something called the BIOS, which is like the very foundational software of the computer that actually relates to it sort of booting up and starting up, which then would render any other privacy or protection devices that you have on the machine fairly useless.
So they can go kind of under the radar. So even if you've got an antivirus or something that's scanning away, what the antivirus doesn't realise is that beneath even the operating system of your, Windows or Apple or whatever, there's stuff going on you don't know about.
Again, I mean, antivirus is going to be useful for criminal hackers. In terms of government surveillance, it's basically useless. The government won't be deploying any software that's known to antivirus providers. And also, again, in the draft investigatory powers bill, we see that the government is giving itself the power to compel software providers like antivirus to not detect the government's malware. So they would have to be complicit in enabling government surveillance.
Now, these big software companies, the social media ones particularly, things like Twitter, Skype, Facebook, Google, these guys have for years been being sort of torn between the signals intelligence people, NSA and GCHQ, and the users. And if you look at the financial incentives involved, it's pretty obvious where they lie, because a lot of them are getting sizable amounts of money from the National Security Agency and from government agencies, and yet almost all of these services are provided free to us, the unwitting public. And it just sounds to me as if slowly but surely these big Twitter, Skype, Facebook, the rest of them are slowly, even companies like LinkedIn are slowly going over to the dark side by saying, well, this is where our money's coming from, and if we better do what they want, otherwise we'll go broke.
Yeah, I think that's true, and they certainly, most service providers have been fairly cooperative with the government so far. But they also, these services, these websites also get vast amounts of money from their users. And if they don't have users, then they are redundant. So the more noise and protest that we make about our privacy and losing that right to privacy, the more they're starting to take notice. And that's why we see now, as part of companies advertising, like although it's kind of laughable, but, you know, Microsoft and Facebook and Google, they're promising their customers privacy because they know that it's something that we actually care about. And I think they will be very hesitant to comply with the British government's demands about, you know, injecting malware on their behalf and passing over data from customers, because I think they just know it's not going to wash with customers, you know, well, say customers, with users. They make vast amounts of money out of our data. They want us to keep using their services. If we turn away to alternatives that protect our privacy, then they're dead and buried.
Well, I mean, I don't pay to use Twitter, Skype, Facebook or Google. So how are they making money out of me?
By using your data, and some services will then obviously sell that to advertisers. And by hosting advertisements, and advertisements are tailored to you, your interests, your activities on their platform. So I think Facebook, for example, earns about, I think the value of an individual's data on Facebook is worth about £5 currently per head, which obviously amounts to an enormous amount of money. And if you think of the value, maybe not for Facebook, but the value for the government is vast as well. I mean, particularly for Facebook, we've seen recently, I believe in Australia, they're piloting a scheme whereby Facebook users' photos are ingested into their national database. Of course, those photos have facial recognition, so it's basically building a facial recognition database.
Sounds to me as if what they're doing effectively is building, using these as a sort of shop window to build up profiles on all of us. So there's massive government databases with vast amounts of information about us. What bothers me, Silky, is that governments are going to start to know more about us than we know about ourselves.
I totally agree. I really agree with that. And I think especially, you know, a lot of people say, I have nothing to hide, nothing to fear. And don't even get me started on that one. But, you know, your web browsing history for most of us is in a way an extension of our digital, it's our digital brain. It's a record of all of the thoughts that we've had, sometimes the feelings that we've had, the concerns, the dreams, the connections and networks we have. You know, such a detailed picture of an individual can be made just from their web browsing history alone, let alone all the other data that we have online, our photos, our health records for some people, you know, your any medical information, tax information. There's such a wealth, you know, your emails, your messages, and increasingly everything is being digitized. Everything is going online. In 20 years, we'll be controlling our heating and our TVs and stereos and fridges and everything from apps on our phone. You know, it will be connected to the internet and the Internet of Things. So protecting privacy in the online space is absolutely central to protecting freedom, to protecting democracy for the future.
What one of the people who's rather worried about this, just like we are, can see a kind of dystopia, technological dystopia, almost a technocracy where the people who control the technology run the whole of society. Is Edward Snowden. We mentioned him a bit earlier on, but I mean, he appeared on the scene, didn't he, about 2 years ago. What do you think's been the main impact of what he's had to say, you know, the main revelations, other than this kind of general thing of saying, well, actually, there is really something to worry about out there, whereas beforehand we didn't have the hard evidence. Now we do with him.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And I think I'm, you know, unendingly grateful to Snowden for being so brave and for sacrificing his personal freedom so that we can even be having this discussion now. And before Snowden blew the whistle, people that were talking about this issue were considered conspiracy theorists, absolutely mad, nuts. You know, it wasn't accepted to be true. Parliamentarians didn't know what was going on, even though they're supposed to be sovereign and run the country. You know, no one knew. So I think his impact has been to inform citizens and enable a democratic process to take place, whereby we actually have the conversation in the first place about mass surveillance. We stop just pretending that it's not actually happening.
I mean, is there anything specific that part of his revelations that has really actually got, you know, raised your eyebrows and said, "Well, crikey, I didn't even dream that they'd be doing that."
What, as in terms of a particular revelation?
Yeah.
Yeah. There is. I mean, I thought prior to Snowden, I thought that some of my suspicions about surveillance were slightly paranoid, and I knew that I would be likely to have a bit of paranoia from my activism background, because activists are targeted not only digitally but by what they call covert human intelligence agents as well, you know, undercover cops. I think I was quite surprised by not just the collection of data, but by, I think, hacking is the thing that surprised me the most, and forcing companies to be complicit in that. You know, the fact that they can take ownership of computers. What remains to be seen is what scale they're doing that on. You know, is it the case that they go, that they're deploying? But in fact, in the draft IP bill, they explicitly say bulk equipment interference. So that suggests to me that they are engaged in bulk hacking. You know, who and why and how that's happening, we don't yet know. We need another Snowden, because things will have changed since, 2013.
That's right, 2013. It was actually during the Bilderberg conference in Watford that both you and I were at. It was actually during that conference that the very first news stories were went around the world about Edward Snowden appearing in Hong Kong, this whistleblower, etc. So do you think there's any kind of connection with this Bilderberg style way of running things? Because they're certainly very powerful people. I mean, we're talking about an organization which first met in 1954, was chaired by the former SS officer Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands for the first 20 years, and has been meeting ever since, once a year at least, in public, but they try and keep it as quiet as they possibly can behind closed doors at a swanky hotel somewhere in Europe and America, and effectively represents the NATO countries' biggest big businesses, with the banks, even royalty, going to these meetings. So I wonder if you make any sort of connection at all between the Snowden revelations and the Bilderberg conferences, because there seems to be almost like another government going on, like the Wizard of Oz, you know, behind the curtain, behind the scenes.
Yeah, I'm concerned about how this infrastructure for transnational mass surveillance came about in the first place. It didn't come about through any democratic process. It seems that the intelligence agencies have become a law unto themselves. That's really, really deeply concerning. You know, anything that any citizen of the UK has been taught, and especially an American citizen, is that, you know, your constitution rules, or in Britain, you know, that we have parliamentary sovereignty. So the fact that something could so dramatically alter freedoms that we have in the UK, that could break fundamental human rights, and could essentially change the direction that the Western world takes in the future, going down a very dark path. You know, that all happened behind closed doors by the intelligence agencies. Then you have to think, you know, if you have off the record private meetings that are granted a media blackout, like Bilderberg, where the Prime Minister attends and has private chats with Eric Schmidt, the head of Google, about privacy and security, you know, digital security, which is laughable coming from those two individuals. It really does make you think, you know, the whole process of government here is massively lacking. Those Bilderberg should not be allowed to happen. It's unconstitutional. And it really makes me worry when you have the heads of government talking with communication service providers like Google and potentially Facebook and others behind closed doors, whilst this whole process, this whole infrastructure has emerged from behind closed doors as well.
I wonder who wrote the IP bill. Maybe it was the Bilderbergers themselves. Who knows? Anyway, thanks very much for joining us, Silke. I'd just like to, before we say goodbye, can you just tell us how people can follow some of your work and possibly, if they're interested in getting all tooled up with encryption software, coming along to one of your crypto parties?
Yes, I'm running a crypto party on the 15th of November in Brighton. I'm trying to organise one in London for before Christmas. You can follow me on Twitter at Silke Carlo, that's S-I-L-K-I-E. And on there, you'll also find a link to my book, Information Security for Journalists, which is available free and has a lot of information about what tools you can use to protect your computer and your devices, not just for journalists. So, you know, that information is, applies for anyone. I'm at silkycarlo.wordpress.com. I'm writing a blog post about the IP bill at the moment, which should be published by the weekend.
All right, Silke Carlo, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your family?
Yeah. Okay. My name is Maz Salim, and I'm the very proud daughter of Pakistani immigrants. My father, Mohammed Salim, was brutally murdered in an Islamophobic attack over 2 years ago by neo-Nazi terrorist and mosque bomber Pavlo Lapshin. My father was a baker and a trade unionist. So there's millions like my father, Irish, Russian, Jewish, Eastern European, that have all come here to work and seek a better life for their families. My father worked extremely hard. He did double and triple shifts at the bakery to feed his family. He gave more than he ever received. Racism has always played a role of dividing people, and we should oppose it, because this country really was founded on immigrants and it's been supported and nourished by immigrants, and we must never forget that.
Tell us a bit more about your dad, about, you know, what he was like as a person.
Yeah, my dad was amazing. He was he was a very educated man, so, you know, he taught us all we know about politics in regards to Pakistan, Palestine, Afghanistan. We used to go to demonstrations with Dad as well, and he always instilled education. He had, you know, we had five sisters, and he had five girls, so he was like, you know, acknowledges power, and make, you know, was encouraged us so much to go to university and study and make the you know, the most of our education system here. You know, Mum and Dad really appreciate what the UK has given to them when they've arrived here. So Dad was like really amazing on the front of like talking to, you know, educating, and also the a lot of the children in the area that were restricted from studying, and there was a lot of arranged marriages going on when we were growing up for the younger kids in the area after they left school. So my dad to go and speak to their parents and tell them, look, you know, education is vital. And so he was like, he was amazing, because a lot of people looked up to Dad in the area. And obviously the older dad got quite more religious, and, you know, and so he used to go to the mosque at the end of the road, you know, five times a day he'd be at the mosque. So everyone in the area knew Dad's routine, because they used to just see Dad going up and down. But yeah, he was a very beautiful pious character.
Do you think it was a random attack, and how was he actually killed?
So my father was leaving the mosque, and bear in mind the mosque is at the end of our street. So this is the mosque we went to as kids. So after school we'd go to mosque between 5 and 7. So it was our local mosque. Dad was leaving the mosque at 10 p.m., which was Isha prayers had just finished. Normally Dad's escorted every night, and my uncle who was with Dad at prayers that night had left early, because he had basically had relatives, so he had to go home. So Dad told him to go ahead. So Dad actually left the mosque about 10 p.m. and was walking home. And then what happened was Pavlo, personally, there was more than one attacker, because we've seen the CCTV that the police dismissed all the evidence. So yeah, it was a blacked out SUV that some of the neighbours did notice this vehicle. One of the neighbours did notice this vehicle. So basically, Dad was coming home from the mosque, and then he was stabbed three times from behind, brutally, like back to front stab wounds. One of the stab wounds punctured Dad's lungs. But Dad actually turned around and went to give chase to the person, and that's when the other stab wound, we think, happened, because we've been obviously trying to look into this case ourselves. And then obviously the suspects ran down one of the local streets, which is where our neighbours live, and obviously we asked to see the CCTV footage from those areas, you know, because the police seem to not be doing it themselves. So we did find the footage on one of the neighbours' camera of the suspect running down the street.
Well, no, I'm pretty shocked to hear that CCTV footage was kept from you, from the family, and from your solicitor. I mean, just tell us how you got to actually get that introduced to the court. That wasn't necessarily by the police then. Was that by you?
No, the neighbours came and gave us all the CCTV in the area. So all the neighbours came to us from the mosque. There's a garage. Everyone came to us and showed us this CCTV, and then we actually told the police, like, look at this CCTV, because if the neighbor's camera was slightly high, you could see more than one shadow around Dad. So, you know, and this was completely dismissed, and the police say no, it's not that. And also the vehicle as well, which was really, really, really vital in the attack, the police dismissed and said no, it was a Villafans looking for a pub. Bearing in mind, we live in a blues area, Birmingham City area. Why would Villafans be in a blues area? So the situation around this, and us, you know, obviously we had a really difficult time with West Midlands Police trying to convince them at the beginning that this was a racist attack, and you know, they literally, and we actually told them, you know, this is what it is, and they were like, and they were, you know, they more or less started investigating in the community instead of going to look further away, just to a football ground, and you know, where this probably could have stemmed from.
Now the actual attacker, this guy who's supposed to have killed your father, Pablo Lapshin, what have you since discovered about him? Because I know he hadn't been in Britain long, and he'd been actually brought into Britain, hadn't he, by the British embassy, and he was, I think, from Ukraine.
Yes. Pablo Lapshin arrived in the country within 5 days, murdered my father. He actually was living on the premises of Dalcam, which is a company down the road from us. And bear in mind, there's four big mosques in Smallleaf that were literally around him. So why did he target Green Lane Mosque? And, you know, Green Lane Mosque has had, Channel 4 did do a documentary a while back saying they were controversial. And then Channel 4 apologised, and then you know, there's reasons why he could have targeted this mosque. You know, there's a lot of information that, you know, obviously we've been looking into it ourselves as well. So he arrived within the country 5 days, literally living down the road from us, and then he basically chose Green Lane Mosque, where he targeted Dad, and then the other three mosques where he put the bombs at aside. They were so far away, Tony. Like, literally, they were so far. One was in Tipton, Wolverhampton, Warsaw. I've never been to these areas, and you know, apparently he caught a bus there. So obviously, we think, and we know this was a premeditated attack, because this was all organised, and we were told by the police he Google mapped it or Google searched it, which is actually, I quite think, is quite impossible, really. So this was a premeditated attack.
Okay, now, how's your family been coping since this loss a couple of years ago?
Every day is difficult, because I've been having a really bad week this week, where I've been missing my dad a lot, and you know, you have moments where obviously I campaign and I stand up to Islamophobia. And then when you have your days, it just suddenly kicks in, you know, the reality of it. I mean, when I'm at home, at my parents now, and literally it's just all the memories of Dad, and he was literally murdered literally outside the house. So we have to walk past it every day. It's just so, it's so hard to comprehend that this happened here, you know, where we've lived literally all our lives. For this to happen, it's still quite shocking. I mean, it seems to Mom that Dad's gone to the mosque and he's going to come back, because obviously it took over 3 months for the coroner to release Dad's body. 7 inquests later, we literally fought and fought with the coroner to release our father's body, because Islamically, he should have been buried within 72 hours. But we understand it's a murder investigation. So two weeks for sudden death or murders, you know. But if it's religious, you need to respect that. So, I mean, that was a really, really tough period for us. And then obviously, on Dad's funeral, which was 3 months later, there were about 8,000 people did turn up to the funeral. And then Lee Rigby's funeral was the day before, and then it was Dad's the next day. So, it still affects us every day, because obviously, you know, Dad didn't die of old age. You know, he died because, or health reasons. He died because he was brutally stabbed to death. So that, you know, especially being an elderly man, it's still quite unbelievable, hard to comprehend.
Other than just blatant Islamophobia and racism, is there any real motive?
It's like, if you look at what's going on today with the Tories whipping up about racism and Islamophobia, with the counter-terrorism bill would prevent, you know, the fear of Muslims, you know, the complete, attack on refugees, you know, being scapegoated today. You know, people are becoming, they watch the news and they believe what they read and what they what this Tory right wing government is giving out on the media. So the motive was Dad was murdered because he was a Muslim, and the way he was dressed, and you know what he represented was being an 82-year-old elderly man who prayed 5 times a day and was a very pious individual. So this is to the current climate times, the current times right now is a very fearful and testing one for Muslims.
Well, what would you say though to people? I suppose they'd be government officials who say, well, you know, we've got to do something because of the danger of Islamist terror. I mean, we're not talking about ordinary Muslims. We're talking about things like ISIS, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but this is it's like, you know, why are Muslims, you know, there's other terrorist groups as well. You know, if you look at what's going on in India with the Hindu extremism, extremists right now, what they're doing in the country, and then it's like Islam and ISIS, and you know, this has nothing to do, this is all being peddled by our politicians here in the UK, where people are, you know, are now looking at Muslims. You know, I've experienced more racism in the last 2 years since Dad's death campaigning, and seeing it like quite blatantly on the bus where I live in Birmingham. I've seen someone abusing a Muslim sister in a hijab because of her hijab, and I've challenged them. And I've also, when I've tried to discuss and debate racism and Islamophobia to the older generation, it's quite difficult. You know, the people are set in their ways, and they believe everything they read.
Now, a hijab, for example, I mean, I may be prejudiced, but I think they look quite nice. I mean, do you feel that there's any reason why people should get upset about a woman wearing one?
A hijab is a piece of cloth. My niece, just last 2-3 weeks ago, she's 11 years old, she wears a hijab, and the bully at school ripped it off her head. And then my sister went to challenge the head teacher because they didn't deal with it accordingly. And they literally didn't give her the support she needed. So obviously we took it further and we spoke to Town Mama. which measures anti-Muslim attacks. And then obviously when they contacted school, the school pulled their finger out and they literally didn't follow the policies on their website. So, you know, these incidences are happening more where women are getting attacked. Actually, the stats that have been revealed by Town Mama UK is 70% attacks on women alone in London, in the London area. So that figure, you know, obviously is a lot more because a lot of women don't report the attacks because they're too afraid. So that's how scary and rife times are today.
Okay, so
people get a bit threatened by the hijab.
Now, but most of us don't really know what's going on with the prevent strategy and the counter-terrorism strategy. Can you tell us a bit about what the government's planning?
Well, the government's planning with the prevent strategy is basically it's a silencing of Muslims. And for example, in one of the schools near us, one of the kids wore a Palestine badge. And he was reported to Prevent, and then Prevent came to his house. He was questioned. He's now on this high security list because he wore to a Palestine badge. So if you're an active a demonstrator, you support Palestine. If you're religious, you have religious views. If you pray, even if you pray in school, you are number one suspect of the Prevent strategy. Because that's basically it's the silencing of the Muslims. It's and also parents are now getting afraid to discuss anything with their children on the dinner table because of what the child might say in school. So, for example, my five-year-old nephew overheard a conversation I was having and mentioned it in school. If you know, if I was talking like about the hijab or about Islamophobia, if he said that any comment I repeated me in the playground, he would. He would be reported to Prevent. I mean, Prevent is really Islamophobic, and it's quite a disgrace that this is happening today in schools. And in regards to Theresa May's counter-terrorism bill, again, you know, how did Pablo Lapshin come into the UK, a known neo-Nazi terrorist in Ukraine? Obviously, you know, if you've read about his links with the Nazi militia in Ukraine, and and the fact that, you know, the far right are not being screened to come to the UK, but whereas if you're a Muslim, you're screened, and you know, your passport can be taken off.
Now, I noticed that Pablo Lapshin even blew up his mum's own house.
Yeah, he blew up his own mum's house, and his father's a lecturer, and obviously, I saw the interview. From the Ukrainian news channel, and his father was like really traumatized, saying, he's not a Nazi, but he may be troubled, but I don't believe he killed anyone, because obviously the parents are the last to know, in regards to horrendous circumstances like this. But he was like, no, my son has no has no Nazi links. But then he said, but he did blow up the house by making, and obviously he's making bombs at home. And then you have saw the footage of him making bombs in the forest, like blowing up trees. So he was a known Nazi in Ukraine. So his links and all his icons were Timothy McVeigh, Andrei Breivik, he loved the Boston bombers. These were his these were the people he looked up to.
Okay, also there is this refugee crisis at the moment. The BBC seem to prefer to call it the migrant crisis. Yeah. But most of these people are fleeing in one way particularly from the carnage in Syria, which Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, has said that the British encouraged him to start a year before the Arab Spring took place. So, Roland Dumas was over in London. He was asked, would you like to help us start an armed uprising in Syria? So it does look like the British were involved, at the very least, in the beginning of arming the opposition in Syria.
Yes.
So what do you make of the way that this has started, this refugee crisis, and where it's heading?
This obviously you know, you look at it, UK, we, our government is complicit in wars in countries, and, you know, we're bombing the hell out of these countries, yet the refugees need to escape. They have the right to asylum and their right to flee a country if they're being rained down with bombs, and, you know, through whether, you know, whether it's also poverty or persecution. You know, this is really important. Now, what's happening in Syria and, you know, in Afghanistan, you know, and Iraq, this is, you know, we need to help our fellow brothers and sisters. I've been working in refugee camps in Calais. I've been there like five times now, and I stay for a period of 4 to 5 days, and I campaign with Stand Up to Racism, and you know, the camps are complete squalor. They're not camps. I don't know why I'm calling them camps. They are slums. So I worked in Syrian refugee camps in Aleppo in 2013. I worked inside camps there. Those camps are at least they had infrastructure, but the Calais camps is no infrastructure. You're literally sleeping in mud. It's freezing cold. Winter is here. Our brothers and sisters shouldn't be treated like this. There's babies in the camp. The water isn't clean. It's Birmingham University scientists went over and tested the water. It's got E. coli and positive for colium as well. There's now scabies rife in the camp now. You know, and literally we cannot provide them with just general basic clean water. You know, clean the camp up, it's just full of rubbish.
But I mean the flow of refugees is not slowing down, it seems to be increasing. It might be that the Russian intervention in Syria makes a bit of difference to that, but at the moment, where do you think this is all heading, Maz?
It's heading, like, the thousands of refugees coming here, and I'm really worried. I've been thinking about this a lot this week. What's going to happen to our brothers and sisters? You know, we should be embracing opening the borders and letting our brothers and sisters in. Tomorrow we are at 10 Downing Street, and we're doing a protest vigil. We've got over 1,000 people coming to that vigil, because we're going to put pressure on David Cameron to allow our brothers and sisters into the UK. You know, seeking a better life is not a crime. I'm really concerned about the racism and the Islamophobia that's being peddled through our politicians, because the majority of refugees are Muslims, and to conflate terrorism with refugees is very dangerous and portrays to the world that all Muslims are terrorists, and this is very reckless and shameful of politicians, and this easily whips up racism and Islamophobia towards Muslims here in Britain. So it's highly, you know, concerning that, you know, the UK asylum policy is saying that they're allowing refugees into the country, like we're saying the UK is saying 20,000 over 5 years, which is, you know, quite shameful, because considering Germany is letting in, you know, 1,000 people a day in. And then what the UK asylum policy is saying, that once they turn 18, we're going to send them back to their country.
Well, what the Germans are saying, Maz, what the Germans are saying is they need cheap labour.
Yeah, no, I've just been reading an article just before you called, and this is it. But you know, with Merkel, is she protect? It's good that the Germany is allowing the refugees in. It's amazing, but we need to protect the refugees, because on Saturday there was a big demonstration called by a big Nazi organization. I don't know if you've seen it online, and it was a really pretty huge demonstration with over 5,000 Nazis, and also they've been burning some of the camps, and infiltrating aid workers in the camps, and also they recently found Nazis with the whole load of machine guns that were going to go into the camp and shoot them. Like, what is happening? We need to protect the refugees. They're fleeing war and persecution, and then they risk their lives to get here, and then you're confronted by Nazis. I mean, it's such worrying times, Tony.
It is, isn't it? And anyway, Maz, can you just tell us if we can follow your work online, if maybe on Twitter, or if you've got a blog, that sort of thing?
I'm on Twitter as Campaigner Maz. So all my campaigning work is on Twitter. So I haven't started my blog spot yet, but when I get a chance, I will.
Okay, Maz Salim, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests Silky Carlo and Maz Salim, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialects, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.